Welcome to Movements in California, a podcast about migration and mobility justice, produced by the California Center for Ethics and Policy, or CCEP, at Cal Poly Pomona, and generously supported by the Cal Poly Pomona Special Projects for Improving the Classroom Experience Grant Program. My name is Brady Collins, Associate Professor of Political Science at Cal Poly Pomona, and Faculty Fellow with CCEP. This podcast will explore how migration and mobility are embedded in many of our public discourses, practices, and politics. What we often think of migration at the global scale, reflected in our immigration and refugee policies, everyday migration mobility is also impacted by local and regional housing, transportation, and social policies that shape where we can settle, live, and work. While some are able to move freely across spaces with little consequences, others have limited options in the space they can traverse and access. This podcast will explore these issues as they relate to different policy areas, from immigration to criminal justice and urban planning. In this episode of the series, CCEP student fellow Raina Miller offers us two stories of immigrant families coming to the United States, one from Mexico and one from China. Her two interviewees and guests on the podcast discuss their unique challenges coming to this country and how they differ from the typical, quote, immigration story we see in the media and pop culture narratives. We hear sounds of the streets of Baldwin Park and Chinatown, important sites of these two stories. They also explore the role that U.S. immigration policy, from the Chinese Exclusion Act to Operation Wetback, villainized immigrants coming from different parts of the world. We ask that if you like what you hear, care about these issues, please share our podcast with your friends, family, and colleagues. Thanks for listening.
This is Raina Miller with Pushing Perspectives, and today we're going to be interviewing two individuals that are telling the legacy of their families and their journeys to the United States in less than traditional ways. In this episode, we'll be going over some technological terms that have to do with some policies and some laws that we have passed in our country, in our historical past. Some like the Yellow Peril, which was from 1888, from 1918, which had to do with the political fear that was instilled with propaganda and different methodologies that villainized the Chinese, in particular, and Asian Americans. We also have events such as the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, which was the 10-year ban on Chinese laborers, which is ironic seeing as these are the very people that we utilized in the historical building of the country as far as railroads and other very extortive methods in which we utilized the Chinese, and yet we created these very blatantly racist laws and policies that were allowed to pass in our country, even though this is the very people that helped build our country. Another couple policies that I help or that we bring up today in our episode is going to be things like the Bracero program, which had to do with the short-term contracts from like 1942 to 1964 that end up only allowing like certain people from Mexico in South America to come here, which was very exclusive. It only, in that same way, very extortive in that methodology as well. You couldn't own land. You could only be basically a young, fit male. You couldn't bring your family. So it was very much just kind of using and being very utilizing of the people. And then obviously Operation Wetback in 1954, which was the mass deportation of Mexicans in the community. And it had like hundreds of thousands of immigrants that were deported. Yet you're still utilizing and extortively using the community and kind of nitpicking who you want while also villainizing and actively creating propaganda against the community as well. So those are just some terminologies that we'll be using in today's episode. So in our first interview, we're going to be interviewing Brianna, and she's going to go ahead and tell us her story about her not not only herself, but also her family and how they immigrated here to America. And our second guest is going to be Ethan, and then he's going to go ahead and tell his story having to do with his grandfather and how he immigrated here to America as well. So let's get started with Pushing Perspectives. Our first guest is going to be Obriana. Hi, Obriana.
Hi.
So, Obri, just to inform our listeners right now and get a sense of who you are, go ahead and introduce yourself and maybe where you grew up and how old you are.
Okay, so my name is Obriana Sofia Del Toro. I grew up in Baldwin Park, California, and I was born and raised there, and then I'm 20 years old.
Okay. And like growing up in Baldwin Park, that's pretty close to here. Right now we're filming in Covina. Did you consider your race and ethnicity to be two separate things, or did you consider them to be the same?
I always considered them to be the same, considering the fact that my mom wasn't really good at speaking English. So growing up, we spoke a lot of Spanish, and it was actually my first language. And then my dad, he's very fluent with both languages. But like I said, Spanish is just something that was always spoken in our household. And our family members are also Mexican, and it's always just Mexican culture anywhere we'd go.
Okay. So with that in mind, what generation are you considered?
So I'm considered to be the first generation.
Mm-hmm. And being first generation, that means your mom and dad came from another country. So where would that be?
Yes. So my dad came from Manzanilla, and my mom came from Colima.
Okay. Are those far away from each other?
I believe they were actually pretty close.
And when did your parents immigrate over here?
Around the age 14.
Okay. And then for them, what are their like age ranges?
So they're 10 years apart.
Okay.
So my dad came 14, and then my mom came, I think she was younger, maybe like 10.
How old are they now? Like as far?
My mom is currently 43.
Okay.
She keeps taking 2 years away, but she's 43. My dad is 50.
So you said that he crossed when he was in his teens?
Yes, early teens.
And what was that like?
He's not open about it. I know he's opened it up to my sister before, mm-hmm. and he just got really emotional, but he hasn't spoke about it since. He only told her once.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Did he travel alone? Do you know?
I believe he did not travel alone.
Okay.
I do know it was hard for him, though, because when my sister opened up about just telling me why she couldn't,
mm-hmm.
I could tell by her face it was just something that I wasn't ready to hear.
What was your mother's story like?
Almost similar, but the only thing is that she was more open about telling me. For example, like the coyotes brought her, and she was young, and she came with her sisters as well, and they had to go under bridges, sleep there overnight, and she told me that the helicopters were even looking for them with flashlights, like looking through the woods that they had walked into or the desert.
And what was the age range for her?
I believe she was younger. She was about 12, 12 or 11.
Oh, okay. And how many people did she travel with?
I'm not sure, but she has around like six sisters.
So oh, wow. Pretty,
yeah. She said that the car took them out
mm-hmm.
somewhere, and then from there they had to walk everything.
That's a lot of like open space too.
Yeah.
That must have been really scary. So both of them came through the border illegally then, right?
Yes.
Originally?
Yes, they both did.
Okay. And then what would they do once they got here? Like, how did they establish their lives?
I'm not sure, but I do know from my mom's side that she had family members already living here.
Mm-hmm.
And with my dad, I don't know if he was homeless or not, but I do know that he used to sell oranges on the streets mm-hmm. to make money. And he would do like any type of work in order to get money.
So they both came from pretty rough backgrounds, it seems like, as far as like their journey getting here.
I definitely say so. My mom lost both of her parents when she was really, really young too. Mm-hmm. I think that's probably why she had to come over here, because mm-hmm. she didn't have any family over there.
Mm-hmm.
And then for my dad, my grandpa was just always really harsh on him.
Mm-hmm.
Like the punishment they would give him is like beyond what I would even imagine.
And what made them choose the U.S. out of everywhere?
I think it's just the promise that the U.S. held for so many of the people, like mm-hmm. the American dream, and just knowing that there is like, there's a home. So it's just like more safe
mm-hmm.
as well. And the laws are just so much different than over there in Mexico. And I do know it was like a lot unsafer back then.
Mm-hmm. So for them establishing their lives here, they obviously had you and your family that they had raised. What was your experience like being here?
So it's been pretty good. I didn't really like get bashed on. I would say when I was younger, I did, but that was more so for my clothing.
Mm-hmm.
It was always a struggle of wanting to like fit in and be normal.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I never really like wanted anybody to really like notice me as much.
Mm-hmm.
But now that I'm older, I'm like, notice me. Yay.
What do you think that stemmed from anywhere that had to do with like insecurities or anything like that?
It was definitely insecurities from my skin tone to the way my hair was.
Mm-hmm.
To just the color of my eyes. It was just so many little things.
Mm-hmm.
And I genuinely just didn't want anybody to see me. And I was in elementary.
You had mentioned Baldwin Park.
Yes.
Was that where you stayed growing up? And how did you feel about your culture being represented in the community?
So Baldwin Park was great. I loved it there. The only reason why I mentioned Pomona was because when they got divorced, mm-hmm. I was in seventh grade, I would say. So mm-hmm. I had to go back and forth, moving to different apartments.
Mm-hmm.
My mom finally moved out by herself. That was, that was in sixth grade. So that part was Covina.
Okay.
But I would stay at my dad's house. We would trade off every Tuesdays and Thursdays. And then every other weekend I would go to like change houses in between.
Mm-hmm.
I loved Baldwin Park though. And I still do, because everywhere I go, it's just always like, Mexican culture. And there isn't a grocery store or a place that I could walk in and they don't know Spanish.
That's cool.
So they know Spanish everywhere.
So you felt really, I would think that you felt really embraced like growing up.
Definitely, especially with all the programs.
Mm-hmm.
Like Dia de los Muertos, they sometimes have days for that at mm-hmm. the park that we have right there locally. So it's awesome.
And did they have growing up any programs in particular that made you feel particularly inclusive, like felt like you were actually like embraced?
Yes. So growing up in elementary school, we had a dual language program.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, they did cancel that. I think that was due to funds.
Mm-hmm.
That was around fourth grade. That's when I started to forget how to speak English and just was like only Spanish.
Oh, cool.
My teacher was great though. She was awesome. I loved her. But yeah, they took that out. And then we had in middle school dual language program. And then in high school, we had Chicanos and Chicanas. We had like clubs. We also had dual language. We had Dia de los Muertos days, Mexican appreciation days and everything like that. So it was awesome.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. Especially because like that's such a unique side that like I don't get to see very often. Yeah. So to hear that like the community's enriched is like pretty awesome. So with that also concluding, would you consider yourself American? Like Mexican-American, American, or just Mexican?
So although I'm pretty whitewashed for Mexican, I always just consider myself as Mexican because there's still like a lot of things that I didn't have the luxury with.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, still don't. Like a lot of people won't understand. Sometimes like I'll like mumble something in Spanish
mm-hmm.
when I'm talking to my boyfriend or like when I'm talking to my friends mm-hmm. and like, it's just sometimes I can look, sometimes I don't. But for the most part, it's like I'm very like I embrace my culture
mm-hmm.
a lot. And I don't feel like I should stop speaking Spanish just because somebody else doesn't understand.
Oh, yeah, definitely not. Period. Okay, well, thank you, Brianna. And we'll be back with our second guest.
This is Rena with Pushing Perspectives, and we are back. We're here with our guest, Ethan. Before, we talked about Aubrey, just as a recap, and how her mother had immigrated here, crossing the border around the age of 5 years old with her older sisters, and that's all that they were with, while her father also immigrated past the border around the age of 12, and he did it with his older brothers and his uncle. So going into the second story, we're going to discuss with our guest Ethan about his grandfather, who actually had fought in World War II for the U.S., and his journey in immigrating to the United States. When we're looking at Aubrey's story, just as a recap, the main tension that we're working with here is people having to navigate and come here for a better life to gain access to things such as education and work opportunities, and going so far as to put themselves into direct danger in order to attempt gaining entry into the U.S. With that in mind, migrationpolicy.org had mentioned that worldwide, the United States is home to more international migrants than any other country, and more than the next four countries, that being Germany, Saudi Arabia, Russia, and the United Kingdom. And combined, according to the UN Population Division's mid-2020 data, the U.S. population represents about 5% of the total world population, close to 20% of all global migrants reside in the U.S. alone. Many stories have not been heard when it comes to difficult and long-term obstacles faced in not only gaining entry to the United States, but providing this type of uphill battle of quote-unquote worthiness in who gets to stay here and under what conditions they get to stay, which leans heavily into this questioning of how inclusive the U.S. really can be and how much it is really a so-called melting pot when policies seen in the past, such as the Yellow Peril, are sprouting up and having new seeds and kind of taking new form with what we've seen happen to the Mexican population as well here in immigration. So when we are going forward, we're going to go forward with Ethan and let him tell his story about his grandfather in the U.S. Ethan, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So go ahead and tell us the story of how your grandfather had immigrated to the United States.
Well, it's a pretty long, complicated story, but from my understanding, the story is my grandfather lived in China with my grandmother up until the 40s. He moved to America and she stayed behind, and his intention was to find some sort of way to bring her back to America. And then while he was in America, he illegally immigrated. He jumped a boat and swam to shore off of the coast of Baltimore. And during that time period, the Second World War broke out, and my grandfather saw an opportunity for him to gain citizenship for himself and the rest of his family, my grandmother and their child. So he went and joined the U.S. Army as a Chinese man who did not speak any English at all. He was extremely small and very weak compared to other people in his unit, but they accepted him for some reason. And during this time period, my grandmother and her child and my other family members were interned in a Japanese concentration camp in China, where unfortunately my grandparents' child, one of my uncles, was starved to death as an infant. Something that my grandfather didn't find out until after the war, unfortunately. But my grandfather was assigned to combat engineering unit and sent to New Guinea, which was very interesting considering he was a Asian male fighting for the U.S. And there was a lot of concerns of friendly fire being an issue and people not believing that he was actually an American soldier and not one of the Japanese. Looking at photos of my grandfather, it's very interesting because he was a very small guy, as I said, and he looks absolutely nothing like the rest of his all-white combat unit. We don't know the details of my grandfather's assignment in New Guinea. Supposedly he worked for logistics and food and supplies and drove trucks and whatnot, and also participated in combat missions where he was injured by enemy mortar fire from the Japanese, where he was injured and sent back to the States and honorably discharged. After the war, he received no Purple Heart or any veteran status or any benefits for his service, though he did receive documentation of his discharge, proving his service and proving where he was during those years and of his training. He was able to bring my grandmother and the rest of our family from Guangzhou, China, to the U.S. due to this as what was called a war bride. However, during the immigration process, for some reason, the customs officials didn't understand Chinese language at all and didn't care to. So our family name was changed from the Liu family to the Li family as it stands now. Something that I did not find out until recently. And so did my father. He didn't find that out until recently. Mm. It was just my grandfather and my grandmother and then a couple of their relatives they brought with them. And they were homeless in New York City. And they're trying to find ways to, I guess, live out the stereotypical American dream of having nothing and building a life for yourself, which they were able to do. They had a further 5 children, one of which was my father, the youngest of the family. And they were successful in becoming landlords. They would own several businesses like laundromats and a loan business, and as well as a restaurant, which was the main pride of my family. It was called the Blue Lotus Inn in Queens, New York. Later on in the, I believe the 1970s and 1980s, there was a run-in where the Homeland Security showed up to the restaurant and dragged my grandfather away out of the house. Obviously, people were very upset about that and confused. And what had happened was because he immigrated here illegally and despite his military service, they never considered him a U.S. citizen and he was never naturalized, meaning him and the rest of the family were all considered illegal immigrants. He's able to prove his service with his documentation and he still had his uniform and his discharge papers, which I mentioned previously, which is how he proved his service, which was how he became a naturalized citizen and therefore the rest of the family as well.
And I remember you mentioning how seeing this kind of trend where even though he had served time and had served in many ways, have you experienced any kind of prejudice or racial bias such as he did in your current life?
Yeah, all the time. I'm half white and half Chinese, and I've never been fully accepted into either racial group. And as a mixed American, you find yourself in this weird place where, well, you know, what do I fill out on, you know, applications and papers and whatnot? And it used to be a source of anxiety for me because where I lived when I was younger, people who were non-white weren't really commonplace and weren't really accepted. And I was looked at as being, you know, strange object almost. And in Chinese communities, no understanding really culturally of Chinese culture or of the language. And so I felt alien to me. So I've always lived in this weird in-between place, unfortunately.
And did any of that change with any of the places that you lived in? Because I know you've told me that you've mentioned that you've lived in New York and like Connecticut, California, obviously, and Atlanta. Like out of all those places, what has been the treatment towards you?
So far, the farther west you go in the U.S., the more accepting and racially diverse the places. When I lived in Connecticut and Atlanta, I saw a lot of prejudice and had to fight for myself many times in the face of racism, unfortunately. And, you know, it's upsetting because what makes people more American than me other than, you know, their racial purity or whatnot like that, you know, America is not a race necessarily, I don't think at all. Mm-hmm. It's a culture and it's a place, not a people, I think. Mm-hmm. Living in California has been a great blessing. There's a lot of people who are of mixed or varying ethnicities and demographics here, as opposed to East Coast states where it's more segregated and racially ethnostate-y to a sense. Yeah, I'm very grateful for living in California, which is the reason why I've chose to live here pretty much for the rest of my life, hopefully.
That's awesome. Okay, well, thank you for your interview, and we will be back with Pushing Perspectives.
Ethan.
Hi.
So you guys have heard a little bit about each other's stories. You guys seem to be coming from, like, it seems two very different experiences, though both had family that came illegally. What do you guys think about that?
So for one, not to compare and contrast, but just listening to Ethan and, like, how his side is, I was like, whoa, like, I'm just so happy for the way that I grew up. And I know, like, my parents, like, it was a hard transition for them to, like, come over here. But they didn't have to swim mm-hmm. and jump off a boat. So mm-hmm. I was, like, really taken by that.
Yeah. Ori's family's experiences are pretty typical. I don't mean to minimize them, but pretty something I've heard several times from other people, similar instances of coming to America through those means.
Looking at the history of America and laws that we've passed, such as for the Chinese, we had, like, the Chinese Exclusion Act. We had movements like the Yellow Peril. And then for the Mexican Hispanic community, we have things like Operation Wetback, the Bracero program. Currently, like, DACA is being threatened, and like ICE has always been, like, a big concern as well. Do you see anything like that happening contemporarily or that can possibly happen in the future to the communities?
I feel like it depends. Honestly, like, the scary thing is that it can come up whenever. Mm-hmm. There could be a terrorist takeover or anything like that. And just the way that the law, no offense to, like, presidents and all that, but the government isn't somebody that I feel like I should trust. So that can honestly happen at any moment in my life. Mm-hmm. It could just happen because of mood changes or something like that. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't be surprised if that did come back. But right now I feel like we're in pretty okay terms.
For me, you know, targets of racism and discrimination come in waves dependent on contemporary politics. So, like you mentioned, you know, anti-Chinese sentiment came around when there's a lot of Chinese immigrants coming to America, and, you know, citizens here were threatened by them taking their jobs or whatnot. And then, you know, it slowly turned into Latinos and Hispanics and Mexicans coming to the country and, you know, supposedly taking jobs, and they were the target of racism and discrimination. And then, you know, since the 2000s, there's been a lot of anti-Arab and Islamic sentiment. And so I think it's just dependent on the times that you live in, and it's a pretty much a constant thing for the country.
What do you think makes it so turbulent for, like, both of your, like, ethnicities and races versus others that seem to be villainized as easily in America?
Definitely large, I would say large waves of immigrants is probably what makes it so intimidating. So there's been very large waves of Chinese immigrants and Mexican immigrants, especially in recent times, is what I think makes it like that.
We went into this pandemic recently with COVID. Did you guys see any effects on your communities personally?
For mine, not really. I would say the biggest thing was mostly just whenever I walked into a mostly white area, they would just look at me like I was dirty, but I didn't really take it personal. I'm not usually in those types of areas as well. So it was something, it was easy for me to, like, look away, especially because I grew up mostly with Mexicans. But I didn't know, like, at school, I played badminton, and badminton don't have, like, a lot of, like, Asians inside of it. You know, we all play there. So just seeing how scared that my friends were because of the Asian hate crime that was going on, because so many people were, like, talking about, oh, they brought COVID. It's their fault. It's his fault. They drink bad soup. And it's just, it was crazy to see and, like, have to hug my friends because they were scared of that.
Well, and you mentioned that even you were becoming, like, villainized as well. Why do you think that that was?
I think it's just the fact that, like, no offense to white people, but I think they're not used to it. They're not used to so many people with different colors and to be in their environment. So whenever they see anybody who's, like, out of color, they're like, oh, immigrant, or, oh, you brought something, like, you're dirty, like, you came from here, you came illegally, even though I was born here.
So it becomes almost like an ignorant generalization.
Yes.
Where they're just like, oh, you're an immigrant, you're not, like, one of us kind of mentality. That's crazy. And what about you, Ethan?
Yeah, so being Chinese American and mixed Asian, there's a lot of, you know, blind hatred and discrimination against Chinese Americans, especially. And I think there should be a clear distinction. There's a lot of what's called mainland Chinese people. So that's people who come directly from China to America. There's a big separation between them and Asian Americans, and the communities are very different. I'm definitely Chinese American. And even though I'm Chinese American and, you know, my family's been here for some time now, we are still treated like we're non-Americans because of things are happening in another country, which is, you know, obscene. But I want to say, you know, it was upsetting or surprising, but it was not really upsetting or surprising. It was more just an affirmation or a reinforcement of my negative perceptions of the xenophobia in America.
Do you think that there's any way to prevent, like, this kind of thing from happening in the future? Because, I mean,
no.
Is it just that fragile, like, of a system that we live in?
No, yeah, it's just societal norms and people's tendency to fear others, or, you know, discriminate against people who are they're not familiar with, especially in this country. And I wish there was some way to say, like, oh, you do this and this to minimize that impact in the future. But, you know, I think it's more of a cultural thing, and hopefully over time, you know, society and culture and norms shift towards away from that.
Well, for both of your stories, all of your families have become very, like, comfortable and successful and, like, a productive part of, like, American culture. And I think what exemplifies truly, like, what it means to be, like, in America, seems both of you guys have families that came the non-traditional way and, like, made this fruitful and positive life in our culture and, like, our part of our culture, what makes up our culture. Is there any kind of message that you would give to that has maybe, like, an ignorant standpoint or maybe, like, a very myopic or closed view of what they think immigration looks like and the generations that come after it?
So I would say, just have an open mind, because growing up and seeing how much my parents struggled was one of the most heartbreaking things. And especially, like, when you get older and you make your own money now and you're a citizen, it's like, I can't even put together how my mom does it, mm-hmm. how my dad does it. It's like, they work extremely hard. And my dad's nonstop working. When he gets back from work, he works like 5 a.m. to like, I don't know, like 6 p.m. He comes home and then boom, he's a mechanic. He's working on cars. He's fixing cars to make money. Mm-hmm. My mom, she works two jobs as well. She does a, like, it's a 9 to 3, I believe, or an 8 to 3. And she does that because she needs to work around my younger sister who has autism, a form of autism. And then not only that, but she has to go do DoorDash. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot of pressure on our parents. So I just think it's like really unfair for people to just be like, they're taking our jobs, or they don't work as hard when they're over here, like literally like yeah. breaking themselves in order to support their families.
I'm kidding. What about you, Ethan?
Yeah. Anybody who's willing to move away from their families and from their own cultures and from things that they know in order to go somewhere else to, you know, hopefully take better opportunities, definitely deserves to have those opportunities and not be, you know, have obstacles thrown in their way, especially from other people. You know, everybody wants the same things, I think, which is, you know, success for them and their loved ones. And there's a lot more that makes people similar than other people might realize.
With your last note, we'll end on like a positive note. Do you guys have any shout outs you guys want to do for your community? Maybe a restaurant or like a clothing shop that you want to talk about?
So I'm a foodie. So there's this place that I go to, and it wasn't since I was growing up. There was a place in downtown El Monte, which I forgot the restaurant, but it was like a mini Vallarta. Mm-hmm. And they had a bunch of little shops there, and there was this Mexican place that we would always go to. But since I don't know the name, I do go to Garduño's in Baldwin Park a lot. And mm-hmm. since I'm vegan, they have vegan Mexican food, which is amazing. So I always go there to get my vegan Mexican food.
Nice.
They have non-vegan too.
Okay. Nice. What about you, Ethan?
Definitely. If you are looking for Asian food, definitely go to Arcadia, California, and look around for the smaller stores and the smaller restaurants. There's definitely big ones there. Look for the smaller ones that don't get as much business.
Okay, awesome. Thank you, guys.
I hope if anything was accomplished today, we were able to challenge your mind. Not everything is black and white, and not everything must be done only one way. These are real people, real stories, and these are members of society that are invaluable pieces of our entire picture that makes up the United States of America. I hope that you take these stories with you and just learn to better appreciate the vast diversities of people that help make up this great country. This is Rena Miller, and that is our final thoughts on Pushing Perspectives.
A special thanks to all the CCEP students who worked together over the past year to put together this podcast series, and for the ongoing advice of our CCEP faculty fellows, as well as the Cal Poly Pomona Special Projects for Improving the Classroom Experience Grant Program. And thanks to you for listening.